Blog Talk Radio.
In Dallas, Texas, on Monday, June the 6th. As we like to do every Monday, we'll be chatting with our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda, a full plate or a full table, whatever you want to say, whenever we get together with our friend Bill. There's a lot of debate about gun control. I thought President Biden's speech was absolutely the wrong kind of speech, but it didn't have much impact, as you can see in the reaction. But let me say hello to our friend Bill Katz. Bill, it's a little humid here in North Texas. I think summer is here, although not officially, I guess, until the 20th. It certainly feels like it, Bill.
Well, I'm looking outside, and it looks like an absolutely beautiful day here in New York. And I don't know, I haven't really checked the actual statistics, but I will later. Politically, New York is kind of in an explosive state. The governorship is up. The mayor of New York is getting very, very wobbly. The state is stunningly unsuccessful in retaining residents. People are flooding out in a storm, and we don't know what's going to happen. There's an attempt by the people representing the Squad Group and, you know, the real lefties to literally take over every aspect of New York politics. I don't think they'll make it. I don't think they'll make it. But the sole survivor of the old group at the end of this year might be Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader. If the Democrats lose control of the Senate, his future is very uncertain. The party has moved on to other groups, to other interests, and I think that he may lose his leadership position in the Senate caucus. It's hard to know, because although New Yorkers don't realize that there are other states in the union, and their senators may feel very strongly in favor of Chuck Schumer, but we'll see. Very, very interesting political situation here.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think I sent you a copy of an article that came out indicating that the IRS estimated that the state of New York lost either $9 billion or $19 billion, either 9 or 19, I don't remember, billion dollars in money that people left the state, so those taxes were not paid in New
York. That's
right. And that, of course, is an impact in your local politics. Those are federal taxes, that's true. But some of that comes back to New York through, I guess, government programs, and also through the number of representatives. New York lost a member in the House this year. So, I mean, it's amazing to me how people don't wake up, but, you know, I don't know. You know, I don't know what's going to happen. Maybe one of these days they'll figure out that they're the only ones left behind, because you're right, people are leaving New York in huge numbers, Bill.
Well, they are leaving for a good reason, and that is the things that make New York attractive are fading away. I mean, New York City is the big attraction in New York State. Look, there's upstate, it's beautiful and all the rest, but it's New York City and it's Manhattan. And when you have a return to the crime rates of the 1970s combined with an absolute nosedive in the attractions in Manhattan and the other boroughs that make New York, New York, which is the theater in particular, great eating, dining and all the rest, whatever the upper class calls it, and a kind of a beauty and majesty about it, it's gone, and there's no guarantee it's going to come back. I think they felt about a year ago it could possibly come back, but then we had this new phase of the pandemic, and in New York, you know, one kid gets sick, and the city goes into a complete panic, because it is really a lefty city where the left wing then starts coming out of the woodwork and say, you must do everything we tell you to do. So you have a city where yes, the prices are still sky high. The real estate prices are still sky high, and people are paying them. You kind of wonder who's paying for what and who actually is moving in. I am guessing that there are an awful lot of foreigners moving into New York, or at least buying property here for stability, which they is really doesn't exist anymore. But, I mean, I remember the days back in the 1980s when Japan was buying everything they could buy up in Los Angeles, thinking that their boom was going to last forever, and they wanted to put their money into stable industries and stable neighborhoods, and they started buying up movie studios at vastly inflated prices. I don't think it was a good buy then. It's not a good buy now. And I think there's going to be a point where people in New York are going to realize one bad year of the New York Stock Exchange and the a lot of their investment can go down the drain in terms of housing and real estate. The state is in bad shape.
Yeah. Well, what fascinates me when these things happen is that, you know, I can understand the ideology of the city council and the state legislature. Obviously, it's left of center. I understand that. But at some point, even somebody left of center has to understand that the economics is hurting the state, and people
yes.
are not going out to eat, and they're not going out to do the show. The other day, for example, I was talking to a friend of mine in Baltimore, and I said, man, nobody's going to the game. Now, they don't have the greatest of baseball team, I know that, but they do have a loyal fan base. I mean, they should
yes.
be able to get 15 to 20,000 people, you know, anytime. And I said, what's going on? And he said, well, people are afraid of coming to downtown Baltimore because they
that's
fear.
Right.
And I don't know if that's the case in Yankee Stadium or in the Met Stadium. I don't know. But it would make sense. I mean, if you're afraid of being assaulted or whatever, you're not going to go to the game. You'd rather watch it at home on TV. At least you're protected, Bill.
That's exactly right, and that's the way people feel. Also, the cost of transportation has gone up so much that whereas at one time going to Yankee Stadium or going to Citi Field or wherever the Mets play, you would take trains. You would maybe take a cab ride between trains. You might take your own car. But taking your own car now has become almost prohibitive. The cost of gasoline, about $4.85 is what I paid last night for gasoline. Then you have parking charges, which in New York are absolutely out of sight. I mean, you could spend $40 in New York to park a car for 2 hours. And then you begin to build up the cost of the game itself, the cost of taking a family, if you're let's say a family of four, and you suddenly are into hundreds of dollars to go to a ball game. So it's that's another side of it. But lurking over everything is the crime situation. It really has gone out of control. We have people in New York today whose main job seems to be to keep criminals out of prison and keep ordinary citizens in prison. That seems to be the reverse of what you usually expect in a government. The mayor, I think, is well-meaning. So far, I don't think he has been effective, and I believe that his goodwill period will soon come to an end because the everyone expected him to jump in and really deal with crime. He hasn't done so, and I think he would like to, but he is being blocked by the fact that his party in the state legislature is completely controlled by the political left. They have no concern about high crime rates. They kind of like high crime rates. They dramatize their view of society. And we also have situations where people coming to New York, many of them will send their children to private schools. And for those, the rest of them, they depend on a public school system that was improving for a time. I don't think it's improving right now.
Yeah, well, I also saw the article, Bill, that thousands of kids have disappeared. They're not going to school. Now, where
right.
these kids are going, maybe they're homeschooling, maybe they're in private schools, I don't know. But the enrollment in New York City public schools has dropped. And that, of course, has an impact on, the finances. All of these things, you know, ideology aside, all of these things always go back to the finances, Bill. And if students are not going to public schools, and I guess that means the public schools are not getting the same money. Everything goes back to finances, and it's just amazing to me how self-destructive the leaders of some of these cities are, that they're willing to destroy their cities just to make a point, Bill.
Well, that's the point. That's an excellent notation you just made, because these are ideologists. Now, America prides itself, or has prided itself in the past, on being an idealistic country, but not an ideological country. Now it's becoming, in some of these places like New York, ideological. The result doesn't mean anything. Only the ideology means something. And what you're also getting simultaneous with that is a breakup of the basic Democratic Party coalition. The so-called minorities, which are supposed to all be in love with each other and moving forward toward an equal society, are beginning to hate each other because they see the other guy getting the pie and they're getting nothing except promises. I think that you have a situation in New York where the Hispanic community no longer feels that it is on the inside and no longer feels that it is benefiting from Democratic management. And you pointed out to me over a year ago that that's happening all over, that there are changes in the political feelings within the Hispanic community. You're certainly seeing in the Asian community, they feel they're treated very badly, especially by the school system, and they are. And you also have the Jewish community, which is influential politically. And outside Israel, I believe New York is the most, quote, Jewish city in the world. And they are furious at the way they are treated by the educational system, by City University of New York, which is now under investigation for anti-Semitism. You just go down the list of groups within the Democratic coalition. They're all angry. And this is not a situation that is good. The election this year will elect a new governor in New York, or keep the one we have now. And there is a strong possibility, according to some of the pollsters, that New York could have a Republican governor, a man named Lee Zeldin, who's a congressman,
yes,
who seems to be leading for the Republican nomination. And I think that primary will be held later this month. But he may have a real shot if the Republican Party wakes up, which is very unusual in New York, and really gets going. We could have another George Pataki, who was the last Republican governor. I think we could have had a Republican mayor of New York City, the last one being Rudy Giuliani, but the party was asleep, didn't seem to think it had any chance at all, and they do what they do best, which is to play golf and have dinner. And, you know, that's the thing. They specialize in that. But I think that from what I also understand, that even in California, there are rumblings of some revolts within the Democratic Party. And the two together could make a powerful contribution to a very different political future than we had expected.
Absolutely.
And maybe a better.
Yeah, no, I think you're right about it. In California, of course, before we leave New York, I wanted to talk about AOC, but let me talk about California for a second. An article came out that the Democrats in California are very worried about turnout. They're worried that they're going to win. Yes, they're going to, obviously they're going to have a primary and somebody's going to win, but the turnout just isn't there. And if you look at all the other, you wrote an article about this recently. If you look at all the other primaries, I mean, the Republicans are turning out in much bigger numbers, and that, of course, means something in November, Bill, because more Republicans are going to turn out in November because, you know, more people are going to vote in the general election, Bill. So if you start with a low number, as the Democrats have right now, it's who knows what. I mean, there could be major surprises in November. I think the level of dissatisfaction in the country right now, Bill, is such. I have not seen dissatisfaction like this. I thought it was bad under Jimmy Carter at the end.
Yes.
But no, nothing like this. I've never seen this level of dissatisfaction, with the country. I was talking to a gentleman yesterday, Sunday, and he was furious that he had just paid $4.45, I guess is what we paid here for gas. And he was saying, why is President Biden going to Saudi Arabia to get them to pump more energy when we've got all the energy in the world right here, not just in Texas, but in Alaska? And if we get the Canadians to play ball between Alaska, Alberta, and Texas, we could take care of the whole thing, Bill.
Well, that's absolutely correct. The obvious answer is the Democratic Party has been taken over by a president who is controlled by the far left. The very first thing he did on Inauguration Day was to attack the energy industry and to start shutting down fracking and drilling. We have all the ingredients here to become energy independent again. That is very much in the national interest. But using global warming as an excuse, Biden has yielded to the environmental fanatics who don't like the country generally, and we are not allowed to use the advantages we have. That is a terrible president by definition. And I think that Americans do see it. I think they are very wise to it. I think they are also getting very wise to the corruption of the American press. I mean, the fact that you could have the kind of trial we had, which ended last week in an acquittal in Washington of Mr. Sussman, who was one of Hillary Clinton's pals, the evidence was overwhelmingly against him, but it was what they politely call a Washington jury. We had the judge in the case was a devoted Democrat, an Obama appointee, who allowed three members of the jury, allowed three people on the jury, I should say, who were Hillary Clinton campaign contributors. I mean, that's ridiculous. That's the kind of thing that goes on in third world countries. And, of course, he was acquitted by a jury that is in the section of the country, D.C., which has the highest level of Democratic majority of any section of the country today. And so the experts on law and the experts on juries were predicting the acquittal despite the evidence. The evidence doesn't mean anything. It's highly politicized.
Well, I thought the evidence, again, I always like to respect juries because I don't want to have it both ways, in the sense that when I get the opinion I want to respect the jury, but when I don't get the opinion, I want to respect the jury too. But in this case, it just seemed to me as a layman watching this thing that there was plenty of connection between him and the Hillary Clinton campaign, including an invoice. I mean, how much more connected can you be than that? And yet somehow they didn't find him guilty. It was astonishing. I think there's a lot of people, I think it was Bill O'Reilly who said that this really smells bad, that there's something bad here. Now, it's not the end of the story, by the way. I think there may be more in Mr. Durham's future here, but at least this one was not. But you're exactly right. The corruption of the press is pathetic. All they want to talk about is January the 6th.
Yes.
It's like the only thing that ever happened in the history of mankind was January the 6th. That's all they want to talk about in these shows. Now, they're not getting audiences, but that's all they want to talk about, Bill.
Well, they have nothing else. They have no accomplishments to speak of. They have no a bench to speak of. If something should happen to the president, there is Kamala Harris, but that's not much of a recommendation. And if she should decide she wants to do something else, become a tennis player or whatever, or drink coffee and do commercials, she could do that. But there's no who's there? Is there a single statesman? I always hark back when discussing the Democratic Party to the election of 1960, where Jack Kennedy was elected, to the nominating process that year. Every single candidate for the Democratic nomination could have stepped into the presidency the next day and not batted an eyelash. They were that qualified. It was such a good group. And look at it today. I mean, if Harris and Biden were out for some reason, who do they have? They have a bench, most of whom are on Social Security and taking Metamucil or whatever it is, talking about the good old days, which in their case is, really old. I mean,
right.
Really old. I mean, really old.
Yes.
And they have a couple of young whippersnappers. But, for example, the Congressman Lamb of Pennsylvania, who did not get the Democratic nomination for governor, is exactly the kind of person they should be looking for. He's a moderate Democrat from Western Pennsylvania. Instead, the nomination went to a real lefty. I mean, we're talking about the kind of a guy who sleeps with a Lenin doll in
right.
bed, just to feel close to the old guy. And and that's what the party has become. People don't realize that a number of the primaries this year in the Democratic Party are being won, if only slightly, by members of the squad group. The reason is they can win primaries in certain areas. They can't necessarily win elections, but they can win primaries. But the party is not righting itself. It should be going toward the center. It should be bringing up candidates who have universal appeal, and that is just not happening.
Right. One, before we leave New York, Bill, I thought this was kind of funny. You wrote about this, about our friend AOC, who seems to be having now an identity crisis.
Definitely.
She doesn't quite know, I guess, what her background is. I always thought that she was a Hispanic lady there who grew up in middle-class New York, and I always thought her family was from Colombia originally. That's what I had heard. But now apparently she feels that maybe she's got some, I don't know, somebody from Oklahoma in her past, Bill?
Well, it's she
like
is
Elizabeth
a,
Warren, I mean, you know, Elizabeth yes. Warren has Oklahoma heritage, I guess.
Yes. Well, yes, Lizzie. I think that's her role model. By the way, a bulletin. I'm looking at my TV screen. Boris Johnson has survived the vote of confidence in Britain and will remain as prime minister. We'll maybe go to that later. But yes, AOC felt the need. She felt the need. She feels these things to come out and say that she's indigenous. And we are, first of all, congratulating her on getting out a four-syllable word. But she now feels that in her past she is really indigenous and a member of one of the groups that is indigenous. She also announced that her family's history is Jewish now and that she will star in the upcoming revival of Fiddler on the Roof.
Okay.
I mean, it's every day it's a new group. I don't know what goes on with her. Okay, I mean, you know, she seems now to be very much a part of the Washington social scene. She's getting married to her longtime boyfriend. She goes to these events in beautiful gowns, and she is now a member of two new groups. She is indigenous, and she is Jewish. And I suspect that by the end of this year, she will find a deep yearning for Norway.
That's right. I thought that maybe by the end of the year she'll say that she was related to Golda Meir, that somehow she was a relative of Golda Meir, you know, that she comes from that generation of very strong Jewish women like Golda Meir, Bill.
Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, do you laugh or do you cry? I mean, Senator Warren, okay, she did not exactly go through life with the integrity of George Washington. I mean, if she cut down the cherry tree, she would have called for a lawyer. And but at least she stuck to one group. I mean, she really claims that she is, you know, related in some way to Tonto, and that she's an indigenous and a member of a tribe that obviously doesn't want her. But
right.
This one goes around from group to group. I think what she does is she pays $10 and collects membership cards.
Right, right.
You know, so it's an old story in New York about the ethnic groups and the number of ethnic groups we have in New York. But usually people who start with one wind up with that same one. I don't know about her. I mean,
who knows about her? Who knows what is next? But it is, like you say, it is funny in one way, but it's not in the other, because this is what the Democrat Party has become today. It's nothing but, you know, you got to check so many boxes, and that's how you advance in the Democratic Party. You check a box,
yes,
and you belong to a group, and that's how you advance. And,
go ahead.
That might be a great way to put together a cabinet, but it's not a very good way to run a country at a time when we have a supply chain problem that our Secretary of Transportation apparently does not understand. When we have an energy crisis that our Secretary of Energy doesn't have a clue about, and that's because these two people were appointed not because they had experience in those industries or those fields, but because they check a little box, Bill. It's no way to govern.
No,
I think
it
people
isn't
are
at
picking
all.
Up on, forgive me for interrupting you for a minute, but I think people are picking up on that. People are saying, this is crazy. They're selecting people just because of whatever little box. I think people are picking up on that, and that's why I think there is a backlash to all of this, Bill.
Oh, I do hope so, although New York still has probably a majority of voters who will automatically go to the polls and elect any Democrat. I mean, the fact
right.
that she can just continue and maintain some popularity, I think I don't think it's coincidental, by the way. I don't think it's coincidental that she announced her indigenous heritage the same week she announced her marriage to a man. Now, had she announced the marriage to a woman, she wouldn't have had to become indigenous
right.
because she would have had the extra box. But now she's lost that box, or at least never had it. So having announced her engagement to a man, I have a feeling that had something to do with her announcing that she's now indigenous and she can check off that box.
Well, I think we're going to take a quick break, but I just wanted to say that I think I'm waiting now for AOC and her future husband to tell us that they're not going to have any babies because of climate change, that there are enough
yes.
people in the planet and there's no reason for them to have a baby and bring another person into the world. My gosh, how terrible is that? So that's, I think, the next big story that I'll be reading about an urgent agenda, Bill.
Well, I think it's probably true. She, you know, I can't wait for her wedding. I really cannot wait for it because I want to see exactly how she pulls it off. You know, I'm sure the bridesmaids will be from a variety of groups. And now, I mean, you know that she's indigenous. They'll have drums, and from the Jewish groups, there'll be Hanukkah songs, and then there'll be somebody else. I think her husband to be looks pretty straight. Oh, can't say straight. It's pretty average to me. I don't think he checks off any boxes. But that wedding will be choice. I want to see that. It's going to be like the UN. You know it's going to be like the UN.
Well, there'll be Lebanese drums, you know, like they play at these weddings. You know, the Lebanese
absolutely.
Drums, and that'll just make it very exciting. We're going to take a little break, Bill, when we come back. A lot of more serious stuff to get into. The crime in the city is a big problem in the country right now. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, chatting with our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Bill, I want to talk to you a little bit about gun control and the president's speech and this terrible crime wave that we're having in our cities. But before we do, I just thought we'd check a little bit about On This Day in History, because there's a lot of big things that happened on this day. D-Day in 1944, 78 years. You know, I think, you know, you and I remember my friend Bob Jaggers, who passed away
yes.
last year. It was always fun to have people like that around. And, of course, unfortunately, they're dying for natural reasons, of course. But it was
yes.
always interesting for me to, on D-Day, to check with my friend Bob and just, you know, talk with him about D-Day. That's fading now, but we do have hopefully some memories and some good movies and people who are going to keep talking about it, Bill.
Well, yes, I've thought about this often because I come from the kind of in-between generation, a little too young for World War II, but old enough to remember it a little bit as I do, that as tragic an era as it was, and of course it was tragic, it was a world war, but it was the highlight of the lives of really a whole generation. It was the war. And having them around, I think, was a great symbol of stability and a great advantage to the country. If you go back to some of the crises we've had since World War II and go back to the transition in the early 60s from the Eisenhower years to the Kennedy years, we had young veterans of World War II who were still alive, people in their 30s, millions of them who went to the polls in 1960, and their very presence was, I think, reassuring to the American people that this was a generation that did it, that survived, that saved the country, that made it stronger. I don't think we have that feeling today.
No,
we really don't. There, you look around and you look at college students who seem more like children than
mm-hmm.
adults,
yeah.
and seem to feel that the country owes them something, when in fact it's the opposite. You look at a political class that is filled with mediocrities and people who you would never want to put in the president's chair, and you find around the world crises, one right after the other, that are bursting on the scene with nobody really to handle them. And,
that's right.
You know, we were lucky, whether we agree with everything these individuals did or not, we were lucky to have a Roosevelt. We were certainly lucky to have a Harry Truman. I mean, the post-war years were critical, and he handled them, I think historians agree now, with great ability. He left office with a very low approval rating, but that changed over time. And we had an Eisenhower in the 1950s to stabilize the country. I don't know who we would get today, and I don't know today whether the kind of journalism we're getting is in any way helpful to the national future.
That's
right.
You
just get the feeling that the journalists are not terribly serious, that they believe that their job is to bring their unbelievable levels of wisdom, which have been acquired over 2 weeks in the classroom, to the scene. It was rare. I always talk about my walk down the block in where I grew up in the New York suburb. I mean, there you turn left, you get a guy who was still suffering from a severe mortar wound. Right next door to him was a guy who was a gunner on a B-17. Right next door to him was a woman whose brother was a merchant captain sunk twice by German torpedoes. Across the street was a guy who was in World War II and then called up again for Korea. You don't have that today. You don't have anything near it.
No, you don't. The other thing today, Bill, on this day in 2004, President Reagan passed away. And it was not a shock, of course, that President Reagan passed away because he was, you know, getting older and in problems. But, you know, it's still amazing to me. I think I was so impressed with the way the public reacted to his death, the tremendous reception that he got. That funeral was absolutely beautiful, the way the country responded. And I think it spoke volumes about how people felt about President Reagan, Bill.
I think you're absolutely right. If you look back on him and try to analyze as best we can the feelings toward him, they went beyond any agreement or disagreement with his views. I know so many people who said, look, I don't agree with him on everything, but I trust him. I like him. I remember the day the Challenger went down, I called my mother, who was living in Florida at that time, and just to comfort her and find out, because I knew how she would feel. And the subject of the president's State of the Union came up. He was supposed to deliver the State of the Union that night. And my mother said, he knows what to do. Now, my mother was a New Deal Democrat. She had a picture of Roosevelt on the wall. And yet she had a confidence in Ronald Reagan. It was visceral. He had a visceral relationship with the American people. You looked at him and said, I know in the end he'll do the right thing.
Right.
And that is the kind of feeling that is golden in politics. It can't be constructed and it can't be defined, but it is that indefinable thing that binds a leader to his people. We have not had that since. We really haven't.
No. We did with Obama, but it was all fake. I mean, I think it was fake because it was basically the news media carrying his bags, I think. So with Obama, it was they were desperately trying to turn him into this great statesman. But I don't think he ever lived up to it, Bill, despite the fact that the media did everything possible to make him successful, Bill.
That's right. I think you're absolutely correct. Also, another thing, we knew that Ronald Reagan loved his country. Obama, not so much. I mean, I think it was perfectly clear he had a certain contempt for the American people. I don't know how he got elected. I think most people voted for him because they thought it was a great moment in American history and we could, you know, advance the country somewhat. I think it was a genuinely decent vote on his behalf. But once he became president, he was a poor president and a man who you felt just did not have the devotion to America that a Ronald Reagan had.
No, not at all. Oh, even George W. Bush. We can disagree with George W. Bush, but George W. Bush was a man who loved his country. And, we can disagree with him one way or the other, but I always thought he would do the right thing for the country, and I never felt that way about Obama. One quick thing, Bill, just a couple of quick more things here. I want to get your thoughts. Robert Kennedy passed away on this day. He had been shot the night before. He passed away today, the next day. What do you recall of that, Bill?
Well, I remember the day precisely because I was at the New York Times, and I was up late that night watching the results of the California primary, which he had just won. And he was speaking at the I think it was the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, and he was announcing his victory, and we'll go on now with the usual kind of speech you make when you win a primary, especially in California. And he started to leave the stand. I was sort of indifferent because I had mixed feelings about him. I had much more positive feelings about his brother Jack. Bobby always struck me as the younger brother who got the job because of the older brother. And I didn't think that he was a man who should be necessarily president, but he wasn't the worst person either. And that was my feeling, and he left, and it was just minutes later that somebody came on the air and said, Robert Kennedy has been shot.
Right.
And I immediately called the editor I worked for just to make certain that he was up and listening, and yes, he knew about it already. And then we went into the paper the next day, and that was the story. Robert Kennedy was shot. It was a stunning development because his brother had also been assassinated. And I think that was the feeling that people had as they tried to recover from the event, that here were two brothers who were shot, killed. They also had a brother, the first of the Kennedy boys, who was shot down in World War II. And again, the stories were run, as they had in many circumstances, about this tragic and yet heroic family that had suffered so much while at the same time having so much. And then there was the recollection. Remember, Kennedy was assassinated not very long after Martin Luther King was assassinated.
That's right.
And we had the sense of a country that was just falling apart. I mean, two major figures assassinated in 1 year. I recall the comments of the new Israeli ambassador, Yitzhak Rabin, who later became prime minister of Israel. And he was saying in his recollections that when he saw all this, he said, is this the country we're depending on? The image of America was terrible. It was just awful. Violent. Ironically, very similar to today.
That's
right. But for different reasons. But the country looked unstable. It did not look as if it could really govern itself. Two major figures assassinated. It was also the year, remember, of the Democratic National Convention, which was violent. I mean, it was just violence in the streets of Chicago, a very bad year. And it ended, ironically, with the election of Richard Nixon, who was a political retread.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the year did not end with the emergence of any great figure come in and ride in on horseback and say, here I am. Nixon was a retread, and yet to a certain degree, even though I did not particularly care for him, he might have been the right man at the right time because he was so experienced and so knowledgeable that he could go in and take over immediately without a learning period. But it was not a good year for the United States.
No, it was a horrible year. I remember that night we were told a good bit early because we had exams in school.
Yes.
The next day, our parents said, get to bed early because you have to study for, you have exams and wake up. So I missed the entire news about the assassination. But the next morning, I remember waking up and my father telling us about it. It was pretty dramatic. One more thing, Bill, about on this day in history, then I do want to get to the current events, especially the president's speech on gun control and crime in the cities. Dean Martin was born on this day in Ohio. Dino Ceretti, I think, was his original name in Italian. I always liked Dean Martin. I thought he, I mean, I know that he was kind of a I guess, whatever they call those singers back then. But I always thought he was a pretty funny guy. And with Jerry Lewis, they were fantastic, Bill.
Yeah, see, that was he was called a crooner. That was the term that was used. He was a crooner. Sinatra was a crooner. Yes, they were. Dean Martin became famous as part of the team of Martin and Lewis, which was the hottest comedy team in the 1950s. Everyone had the same reaction. I mean, well, Dean Martin is the straight guy who sings, but it's really Jerry Lewis who's the genius and who makes you laugh. And when they eventually broke up after these years of success, the feeling was, well, Martin will now, you know, fade away, and we will have Jerry Lewis, the genius. It turned out to be exactly the opposite. Martin had a certain appeal to people as an actor, as a singer, as a host, that Lewis did not have. Lewis was frenetic, funny as can be, but frenetic. But Dean Martin is somebody you sat down with and kind of talked to or talked with. Very attractive personality, terrific smile. His theme song, Everybody Loves Somebody
right.
Sometime, was well known throughout the country. He had a television show which was so relaxed he never remembered a line. The whole thing was done with cue cards. He was looking at cue cards during the show. And yet he was incredibly popular and very much a beloved figure. At the same time, Jerry Lewis was the one who started to fade. And I will tell you from personal experience, having worked the Tonight Show, Jerry Lewis was not much of a he wasn't a very nice guy, and that was part of the problem, that Martin was a nice guy privately. Just a sweet guy. Lewis was – he was difficult. He was vulgar. And I think that even within the industry, people turned away from him. And as a single, without Martin, he really didn't have that stuff of an individual comedian
right.
the way, for example, Jack Benny did or Bob Hope did. And he became very popular in France. The French regarded Jerry Lewis as a genius, and he became known in America primarily for running the muscular dystrophy telethon.
Right.
Aside from that, his stardom faded in America.
Yeah, I never liked his movies by himself. They show him once in a while on that retro channel. I cannot deal with him. They're just not as good. I keep asking, where's Dean? Where's Dean? You really need Dean.
That's right.
But yes, those movies they made back in the 50s were absolutely fabulous. Well, let's talk about one big issue in the country today, and that's crime. Over the weekend, you know, Philadelphia, I guess, wherever else. And I thought it was interesting. The mayor of Philadelphia came out, and he was very outraged, you know, very angry at the fact that there had been a shooting in his city. And I said, okay, I can understand that, but why aren't you doing something about the crime? You know, why are you tying the hands of the police and letting these criminals run your streets? That was my reaction to the mayor, because whether it's Philadelphia, whether it's New York City, Baltimore, Milwaukee, Chicago, L.A., San Francisco, other city I forgot here in this list, they're all the same. They're run by Democrats, and they're very poorly run by Democrats, Bill.
Very poorly run, and these cities are in terrible shape, and yet very little is done about it because the Democratic Party and its mayors are beholden to the far left of the party. These cities are primarily known today as the home of minority groups, and the minority groups, at least today, I don't know if it'll be tomorrow, are run by hard leftists. I mean, the day of the true centrist liberal, you know, center-left liberal, national defense liberal, is over. There are very few of them left. The ones who try to speak up on behalf of some sanity are immediately shot down. The squad has made it very plain that they will primary anybody in the party who does not go along with their point of view, and they do, and they sometimes win. Now, not always, but they have had a couple of people nominated in primaries this year and nominated over Democratic incumbents who were much more reasonable. So the handwriting is on the wall. The instructions have been sent out. Mayors today put their loyalty to the left wing of the party ahead of the good of their city because they have to in order to survive politically.
Yeah. Well, you look at these crime statistics, and then, of course, the usual thing that happens is, well, we got to have more gun laws and more gun control and more gun control. And I'd love to know what gun control would have stopped what just happened in Philadelphia, or what happened in Milwaukee a couple of weeks ago where two groups went at each other after an NBA game. I mean, what gun law would have stopped any of that? These people already have guns. And
that's
if
exactly
they're
right.
Not buying them legally. In many of these cases, these are high-powered weapons that they're buying in the black market, Bill.
Oh, absolutely. And many of the guns that they want to ban, the gun banners, are guns that are very rarely used in crimes. You know, we did have a few this year that were carried out with is known as assault rifles. An assault rifle is really just a semi-automatic rifle that has some additional military properties. But most crimes are committed that are gun crimes are committed with pistols. But you look at these crimes, as you pointed out, which one of them would have been prevented by gun control? And the answer is probably not one of them. There may be other things we can do, but the Democratic Party, as a matter of policy, always puts the emphasis on the inanimate object, the gun, because they cannot put the emphasis on the shooter for
right.
political reasons. They are
sure.
they're really trapped. And there was a discussion this morning on one of the news networks. Are we going to get some real discussion about the root causes of crime within communities? And I know exactly what he was saying, and that is the lifestyle that is often lived by certain groups within Democratic cities. I don't think we're going to get that discussion. But without that discussion, we will never solve the problem, because it leads into discussions of fatherlessness, which is a very big problem in America's large cities, and into problems of school performance. This is a very, very difficult, very sensitive subject, and it is getting more sensitive, not less sensitive.
Well, you look at the case here in Uvalde, Texas, Bill, the famous case. Here's an 18-year-old young man. The parents are completely out of the picture. I mean, he doesn't even see his parents anymore.
Yes.
He's being raised by a grandmother who, I mean, I pity the lady. She was probably doing the best she could, you know, trying to control this out-of-control kid. This kid is going to school. He's cutting his face when he goes to school. He's telling people that he wants to hurt women. He is putting things online about what
yes.
he's going to do. And somehow nobody picks up on that, Bill. It's like, gee, oh, he's a totally normal kid, you know. He's a totally normal kid who's going to get a scholarship to go to Texas A&M to major in engineering, and he's got a wonderful family to go with it. No. This is the
yeah.
exact – I mean, this kid is was a time
bomb. A time
bomb.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A time
and nobody
bomb.
Picks up on it, Bill, and then they want to blame the guns.
Well, yes. Well, that's it. There is no question that the mental health aspect of this needs to be discussed, but discussed openly and honestly. I don't know if we are going to have that discussion, because you're right. You look at those, all these cases, I think all of them involving major shootings in schools, and you find that the shooter had a history. Why this history was not examined, why the shooter was not examined and detained, possibly even put into a different institution. In a few cases, I think some of them were for a while, but we do not take it seriously. We really don't. And we should be on the watch all the time. The schools themselves should be hardened with defensive mechanisms that can be employed immediately. You know, the old story about criminals, they always choose the path of least resistance. And if they see an armed guard at a school, they don't want to attack that school because they may be killed before they get a chance to do their damage. That we need that, and we need a much more serious approach to troubled children. And
right.
it cannot be something that comes out of the intellectual wing of some medical college where they want to try something new. We haven't got time to try something new.
Mm-hmm.
We have to lock people up who are exhibiting, you know, consistent with constitutional protections. We have to lock people up who are a danger to society.
Right.
And we have to be able to identify them.
That's right. Well, in the case of Buffalo, in the case of Texas, in the case of Florida, there was plenty of information from these kids for them to have ended up in a, you know, for this information to end up in a background check. So at least they couldn't buy a gun. The kid in Buffalo had had conversations, I guess, with experts of mental health, but this was never put in the background check, Bill. And then,
that's right.
You know, then we're saying, well, we need more background checks. Well, why don't we use the ones we got and try to do
that's
something
true.
With the ones we got?
That's true. And you also have a situation with the assailant in, not in a school shooting, but in Wisconsin, who drove into a crowd, remember, drove into a parade and hit it and killed a number of people earlier this year. He also had a background and a history. And with somebody like that, he should not have been allowed to not only own a gun. This was done with a car, but it should go beyond that. People like that should be in some way put under observation and may have to be taken out of society for a while,
right,
while they are observed and treated. But nothing was done. And if we only got serious on that one point, I think we could make progress.
Well, I think so. I think you're right about locking the schools and making sure they're safe. I mean, when you drop off your kid at school in the morning, and I did that many times, I mean, you want to make sure the doors don't open. I mean,
that's
it happened in Uvalde. I mean, that's not an unreasonable request for parents to have. Let me, we're running out of time, and I do want to go to the president, President Biden's speech, because I thought, honestly, it was a major disappointment. I mean, with a country that could have used a different speech, Bill, I mean, he just, I don't know what in the heck he said, but he didn't bring the country together. I mean, he's talking about an assault weapon ban that has already happened. And I mean, it's like I'm sitting there saying, who wrote that speech? It couldn't have been someone who's serious about anything, Bill.
Well, of course, look, he's out of it. Now, whether it's for medical reasons or for reasons of age or reasons that have to do with the people around him and what they tell him every day, I don't know. But when he makes a speech, it does not seem relevant to the United States of America at this time. And he seems like, you know, we talk about what would the fly on the wall here at the White House. Well, the problem is he's the fly on the wall, and he's not hearing anything. That's that's the situation. He is out of touch with his country. So is his party, and so is his administration. His cabinet members appear on the air. They all seem like buffoons. They may not be, but they all seem like they're simply stating a party line that is irrelevant to our times. I'm looking during the broadcast. I always keep the news on to see if anything is happening. Boris Johnson just survived a vote of confidence. But, you know, we wonder, we look at this and we say, how do other countries deal with the kind of leadership crisis we have right now? Because it is a leadership crisis. The Constitution is basically silent on that because we don't have, for example, special elections for the presidency. We have an election every 4 years. Removing a president is extremely difficult. We actually never have removed one. We've had impeachments, but the president has always survived. Nixon, of course, resigned, but we have never had a president removed. And you do get the feeling that structure, which was established for stability, that we weren't going to be a country that removed its leader every 5 minutes, that maybe we've gone a little too far with that, and constitutionally we might have some relief through a procedure similar to that of some of the parliamentary countries like Britain, where you can have a special election called under certain circumstances, because we need it.
That's right.
You think about the fact that this man is going to be in office for another 2.5 years. This is not good for this country.
You look at his approval ratings, Bill. He's at like, you know, I saw something today that it's like 36, 38. How in the world can you get anything done? I mean, when you're at that level, your party doesn't pay attention to you, and obviously the other side doesn't pay attention to you. So when you give a speech like you gave the other night, I mean, it's a waste of time. Now, you mentioned Boris Johnson has survived a vote. I guess that, as you say, that just broke as we were doing the podcast. Maybe we can talk a little bit more about the next time and what that means.
Yes.
Because I think people in the UK, I'm not exactly sure why they're angry at Boris Johnson, but maybe they're saying, you know, I guess they got their own problems too, just like we do, Bill.
Well, yes. Well, he is very much in the Trump tradition.
Mm-hmm.
He has very good ideas, but he personally as an individual is rather wanting. He's not mean in the way that Trump is. He doesn't go after people, but he is an eccentric. And he the issue here was that he kept on breaking his own COVID rules. He would have big parties or go to big parties without masks, while the people of the country had to wear masks everywhere they went. And it began to build up that he was out of control. He can be very scholarly. He is a very knowledgeable, very bright man. But on the other extreme, he sometimes acts like a buffoon. Johnson does, and it finally came home to roost, and many of his own party members demanded a vote of confidence. He won that vote of confidence, but he is still a hobbled prime minister. I'm glad, though, he will get some time because he is a very good ally to the United States, and on matters of foreign policy, we need his leadership a lot more than he needs ours.
Right. Well, I'll tell you quickly how Trudeau in Canada has gotten around the vote of confidence. He represents, of course, a minority party. The Liberals got like 34%. So he started a relationship with another crazy party. So between the two of them, they can stop any confidence votes. So maybe that's the solution. What Trudeau is doing up there, you know, where he's just, you know, he cuts a deal with another small party so that he can stay in power, Bill. Maybe that's
the
solution.
That's true, and he is out of it. Also,
does
not seem to know what's going on in the world. And Canada, look, Canada is a mild country. It's not a threat to us. We don't have a threat coming from our northern border. Canadian way is a softer way. So it isn't that big a factor to us, but I think Canada could stand a dose of real leadership for a change.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Trudeau is what happens when you make these deals and you're basically staying in because you can somehow get enough votes to keep the other side from giving you a confidence vote or forcing a confidence vote. As always, Bill, thank you for your time. It's always a great honor, a great pleasure to chat with you. And I thought your story about Dean Martin was great. And I'm glad that we had a chance to talk about that because I always loved Dean Martin. Always loved him.
Absolutely. Me too.
Thank you so much. And keep up the great work at Urgent Agenda. And we'll see you the next time, Bill.
Thank you, Silvio. Looking forward to it.
All right. Thank you so much. Our good friend, Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. We do this once a week. We call it the Week in Review, have a chance to look at stories, and every once in a while talk about Dean Martin, who was one of my favorites, who was born on this day in 1917. Thank you for listening. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, and we'll talk to you later.